Coming up on Tech News Today, Apple and the FBI take it to a judicial hearing. The new Phantom 4 drone will not hit you, don't worry, but it will stalk you, so maybe worry. Microsoft and Google focus on security that will protect you from yourself and more. Tech News Today is next.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
Hi, everybody. It's time for our annual audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It helps us understand our audience better, know what you like and don't like, how you listen to the show. It also helps us tell advertisers what kind of people listen. But I promise you, your feedback is always kept personally anonymous. All you have to do is visit twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. It'll just take a few minutes and it'll help us make Twit even better. We really appreciate your support. And any help you can give us, twit.tv/survey.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1460, recorded Tuesday, March 1st, 2016.
This show is sponsored by NatureBox. NatureBox is dedicated to making smart, delicious snacking easy. They have over 100 ridiculously delicious snacks that get delivered directly to your doorstep. Visit naturebox.com/twit to get 50% off your first box now.
And by ScoreBig. Pay less for quality seats to your favorite sporting and music events. Go to scorebig.com, click on the microphone, and enter promo code TNT to save $20 off your first ticket purchase.
And by PillPack, a full-service pharmacy that combines modern technology, convenient packaging, and personalized service to make your life easier. Visit pillpack.com/twit to save $20 on vitamins and OTCs when you transfer your prescriptions. Hello and welcome to Tech News Today. This is a show where we talk about all the tech news with people who adore technology.
Oh, they love technology.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In love with technology.
Running through a field of flowers with technology.
Yes,
that's
beautiful.
That should be our subline.
I am Megan Maroney.
And I am Jason Howell. Joining us is someone who I guess I can kind of envision Serenity Caldwell from iMore running through a field of flowers with technology. How's it going, Serenity?
Sure. I just frolic through with an iPhone in one hand, a MacBook Air in the other. I'm doing well. How are you guys?
We're doing all right.
You roller derby through technology.
Yes, that's probably more likely.
There we go.
So you do, obviously, you're with iMore.com. You're no stranger to the network, but tell people a little bit about some of the stories that you like to write for iMore, things you do.
Oh, gosh. All right. So recently on iMore, I've been writing a lot about the iPad Pro and the Apple Pencil. I do a lot of drawing when I'm not writing up storms for iMore. So I've been taking an angle recently on teaching artists how to draw. We've been doing a new column on iMore called Coding Corner, which is all about learning some of the technical aspects of both Apple's operating system and the web. We did a really, really great article last week on how to get into Terminal, which, you know, as somebody who had always kept a far distance from Terminal, I was a little skeptical going into it. I'm like, I don't know if I can properly teach this. And then once I got into it and once I learned some things, I felt really confident. And then I was like, yeah, everybody can learn Terminal. Terminal shouldn't be scary at all. It's much easier than it looks. The screen, the little window shouldn't be as intimidating as it is.
It is intimidating. Like I rarely ever use Terminal, which is the problem. Like, I know how to use it enough to do the things I need to do. Usually it's, you know, things like, you know, tweaking around with my Android device or whatever. But then I don't use it for such a long time that I forget all the things that I learned and I almost always have to look it up. I'm scared I'm going to, like, destroy my computer when I go into Terminal. That's just fear of nothing, probably.
But. Yeah.
Oh, no, that's my exact same fear. And I'm really glad, you know what, Jason, maybe you can jump on board the Coding Quarter series with us and conquer your fears.
All right.
Unix spaces aren't so scary.
Let's do it.
All right, let's get into the news. Did anyone have flashbacks to the Nixon Watergate hearings today? I didn't because I wasn't born yet, just barely. But maybe you were, and watching the FBI's congressional hearings today might have been just as exciting or more so. Among the items discussed were code as a free speech right, conscription to labor, how the FBI's request would affect people in the U.S. as well as the rest of the world. Do you guys have any favorite quotes from today's hearings? My favorite quote was, I don't know.
Oh, did you hear that a few times?
Yes, from James Comey. Yes, there was.
I just don't know. this hearing was pretty fascinating, despite it being a very long C-SPAN traditional. All right, yeah. We're going to get a bunch of senators and congressmen basically feeling their way through the strange and often complicated world of encryption. And I was actually impressed just how many folks came in with some of their homework being done. I've seen hearings like this before and in past where, you know, a congressman will come in and have basically require a complete rehashing and ask really crazy inane questions. And while that did happen in this hearing, it happened to a far lesser degree than I expected. There are a lot more educated congressmen and people willing to talk about the actual issue at stake rather than overbloating it.
I couldn't agree more, because we've been talking a lot about how it's like, oh, they just don't understand. The lawmakers don't understand. The FBI doesn't understand. And then it was really a relief to really see everybody asking what I felt were the right questions. Unfortunately, it did not seem like anyone was compromising on either side, really.
Well, of course. I suppose this is day one, so we'll see what happens. Dr. Susan Landau is she's a professional in the security world, and I actually found a lot of what she had to say pretty interesting. She basically said that the FBI is not up enough on InfoSec, needs to improve its technical abilities as opposed to asking a company to kind of write their way into it. And also, she brought up the really good point that, you know, it's not just people's phones in their pockets. It's also, you know, that people are using, you know, phones are more and more used as authentication for things that are actually very important, things like power grids and all that kind of stuff. That if the defense is, oh, well, this will never fall into the wrong hands, which is what we keep hearing over and over from, you know, the side of the FBI, that, okay, well, you may feel that way, but you never truly know. And hey, there's a greater risk than just, you know, the phone in somebody's pocket. It could actually affect a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I was so very glad to see Ms. Landau on this panel. I think, as you said, Jason, she had a whole number of remarkable things mm-hmm. to say, with especially in regards to the larger picture of encryption, yeah. Not just about two-factor authentication, but how encryption affects our day-to-day, how it affects not only phones, but we're talking about encryption on a wide scale. We're talking about encryption in other devices. And I feel like it's a very different message coming from someone like Ms. Landau, who has the decades of experience in this field, in contrast to either the director of the FBI or Bruce Sewell, who's Apple's legal counsel, because, of course, they're going to be fighting for their respective sides. And I think Ms. Landau truly is fighting on behalf of encryption as a technology. Not, you know, this particular case or not this particular case, but the big picture ramifications of what it means for InfoSec and what it means for the United States as part of the world powers going forward, whether or not we choose to have encryption in our lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what direction this goes. It seemed to me like the majority of the representatives there want it to be figured out, you know, to work out a law, want Congress to kind of be in charge of that. FBI Director James Comey really wants the courts to, you know, wants to go in a completely different direction. So
he really does not want that legislation. He doesn't want to go down the legislative route.
He does not.
Not even for the big picture, which I found really interesting about today's hearings was, A, we've got pretty much the first official time that Comey has acknowledged that this version of the All Writs Act could be used to unlock other phones. Mm-hmm. And you also have this horrible, very FUD-inducing quote, which I'm paraphrasing from Engadget's live blog here, where it's like, I worry that it's hard to have nuanced discussions like this in the wake of terrorist disasters, and are Congress members prepared to possibly be blamed for favoring privacy over the idea of national security in the wake of some future attack? And basically, that happens around, I think, 3:27, if you're looking at the live blog. But essentially, he's saying, you know, well, this may, you know, this case is about encryption. You know, a horrible tragedy has already happened. But think about all of the tragedies we could prevent if there wasn't this pesky, horrible encryption thing standing in our way. And unfortunately, that is a powerful argument, but a slippery slope argument.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting because I think, you don't find that many times in your life that you're really thinking about the three branches of government, you know. So I think, like, there needs to be a law. Like, we don't want this in the courts. It really reminds you how this works. And it does seem to be working in the way that the government is supposed to be working, which is interesting. I also, I loved that Comey admitted, because, you know, he said it wasn't a mistake that the FBI ordered them to reset the phone. Because that was, you know, they could have had so much information if they hadn't reset the password, the Apple ID password on the phone. And, you know, for a while, Comey said, well, that wasn't a mistake. We meant to do that. And today he admitted, you know, that was a mistake. So, well.
FBI are people too, okay?
It's better for them, honestly, from a political standpoint. It's better for them to admit sheer incompetence than it is to admit malicious intent. Because if they pointed it as, oh, this wasn't a mistake, we meant to do that intentionally, that lends credence towards the theory that essentially the FBI was building this case to try and honey trap Apple.
Now, somewhat related, I suppose, well, maybe not related directly to the case, but definitely related to encryption. Whitfield Diffie and Martin E. Hellman, the creators of Public Key Encryption, were today announced to be this year's Turing Award winners. Their work in the 1970s actually stemmed from the desire to create a system that would replicate the signature, but in a computerized world. And that ended up leading to what we now have, which is Public Key Encryption. The timing is very interesting here. Obviously, this award was probably not prepped because, hey, there's an Apple FBI thing, so let's give it to them. This thing happens far in advance. But I do feel like maybe, you know, there is nothing coincidental with the fact that this is happening right around the time that, device encryption has become a regular, you know, activated by default sort of thing. And I don't know. I think it almost feels like, wow, it took this long for this kind of recognition, because encryption is such a major part of security today online.
Absolutely. I really think that encryption has, as you said, has flown under the radar for a long time, specifically because it's a hard subject to explain to your average layperson, especially somebody who's technology illiterate or has no desire to learn about the features behind their computer. I think that we're finally hearing a lot about encryption, in part because it's ending up in the courts and all of this business with Apple. But we're also hearing about it because Apple and other companies have chosen to take such strong stands. And we're hearing about it because of hacks that are happening. Because, you know, when the average person sees the Home Depot hack happen, and then they hear things like plain text keys, they don't know what that means. So there's been a much bigger push to explain the benefits and the perils of ignoring encryption to the average layperson in the last, I would say, 3-4 years. So this feels very coincidental. It feels like, oh, well, this big encryption fight is happening, and here are, you know, these people getting an award for inventing public key encryption. But really, I think it's just a convergence of all of these things are slowly bubbling over into the public awareness. It's like that memory trick where you learn a word for the first time and then suddenly it's being seen everywhere. Encryption's been on that rise. People are hearing more about it on a day-to-day basis. Companies are explaining in a good, cohesive way what it means. And now we're getting public recognition as well because the public knows more about it, which is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it should be noticed that Diffie and Hellman, the NSA wanted to contain their technology back in the first crypto war too. Like, this has been going on for a long time. And both of them came out to say what they had thought about this, you know, case, this current case. Hellman signed one of those friend of the court briefs, one of the many friend of the court briefs backing Apple. And Diffie also had recently co-authored a paper about it, posed questions to the government asking these specific questions before they started demanding a backdoor. They're both, I think, on the side of encryption, or on the side of Apple, whichever you'd like to say. But yeah, I definitely think they deserve this recognition.
The $1 million cash award.
Which they have to split, admittedly.
But they're actually going to put it to good use. Hellman's using his portion. He does a lot of study into the threat of nuclear weapons on humans. So he's going to be putting a lot of that into that ongoing focus. Diffie is putting that portion into documenting the history of cryptography, because as he says, like, a lot of those people that were there in the early days, like they're starting to kind of die off and everything. And then this is history that needs to be logged in some way. So
mm-hmm. I see a Benedict Cumberbatch movie in the future, but yeah, which probably. One will he play? Man.
Yeah, no, I mean, speaking of movie, like there are so many movies that are being created right now based on things that are happening around encryption and security and all this kind of stuff that are going to be, you know, inspired by this. Yes, we are creating many movies. We just don't know that yet. We don't know those.
Oh, I can't wait to see the version of Spotlight that's all about Apple's fight with the FBI. I know it's coming. Yeah. Yeah. It's going to happen.
Glenn Close as Landau, maybe?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
See it?
All right. Well, happy Super Tuesday, everyone. Today, the Associated Press released Election Buzz, a partnership with Twitter and Google to help voters make sense of the political noise on social media. So, yeah, it is noise. And this, I have to admit, help me make any more sense.
I was going to say, this is kind of noisy, too.
I love it. But it's based on Google Trends and Twitter results. And, yeah, it's... I'm sure it makes more sense, but I'm just checking Nate Silver's site because that makes even more sense than this.
I guess I'm just going to reveal the fact that, man, I've had my head buried in the sand when it comes to the election. I just have not wanted to focus my attention on it. And I know I'm at the point to where I really do need to start focusing on it now. This is, I suppose, as good a place to start as any to kind of see where the collective trends are. But I don't know. What do you think, Serenity?
Gosh, this page, I have to agree with Megan, the charts are not particularly helpful. Yeah. The charts just feel kind of like charts. I appreciate the comparison between Google and Twitter, but at the same time, it's hard to say what that, like Twitter conversation volume, I'm looking at Christie endorsing Trump. It's like Twitter conversation volume 550 to 2. And it's like, is that tweets per hour, tweets per second? Tweets, and then it's like Google searches, search interest versus direct search. It's a little fuzzy just looking at it. What I think is much more interesting is actually the search interest for candidates based on charts down below and conversation drivers, what's happening in the past 24 hours, how many more tweets are about Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump and John Kasich and national security, and what share of the conversation are they? That part is more interesting to me as somebody who likes to follow general Twitter trends. But I have to agree with Megan, honestly, Nate Silver's site 538 is one of the better places to find election coverage, especially because it's done in a style that doesn't necessarily treat you as stupid, but treats you as here, you want to be informed. We're going to help you make informed choices, and we're going to, you know, explain where we got this data in a way that doesn't make you feel like you're drowning in numbers. But I appreciate, you know, I do appreciate that the AP worked with Google and worked with Twitter to put this together. I think the more information that's out there, the better. If it could be slightly better curated, that would be fantastic. But I appreciate that there's an effort at all, because I do think, I mean, this election, no matter what side you're on, has, I feel like there's a little bit of, not necessarily apathy. I was talking to a friend of mine on Twitter today about how it's kind of like angry apathy, where you're not really happy about anything that's going on, but there's not really, you know, it's so hard to describe. So I appreciate the fact that sites like the AP and 538 are at least, you know, being like, maybe this isn't the most, you know, promising presidential election following the elections of 2008 and 2012, but we're going to put our best foot forward and we're going to try at least give you some information so you know what you're voting on.
Because you got to vote for somebody, right?
Exactly. Because you have to vote. You know what? Please vote. If you're in a Super Tuesday state, and I mean, I think the polls close in another like 7 minutes for Massachusetts. If you haven't voted yet, Massachusetts, please go vote. Please vote if you're in Super Tuesday state. As I said, I can't strongly recommend a candidate, period, but But vote. Voting is important. No matter who you vote for or who you believe in, please vote.
538.com does have a leg up on the AP poll in that it also has NBA predictions. Just saying. They're there over on the side if you're really curious about that.
Right. You can't vote for one of them.
SB Nation. Oh, gosh.
I want to bring up one point. I mean, repeat one point. You said the anger. I definitely agree with it. That's the most troubling thing. There does seem to me this just undercurrent of anger on both sides, which is really scary, and it's coming out in a lot of different, people who are voting for all kinds of candidates. There's just anger of not being treated right by their party, and it's scary. And I think it's interesting that maybe 3 or 4 months ago, I would never have said that the amount of tweets would equal votes, but I think that is sort of true. At this point, I do think that, like, the more attention that Trump is getting on Twitter, I used to just say, well, that's just because it's entertaining. But I think it is equaling votes.
We will certainly find out very soon.
Well,
polls are closing.
Yes, exactly. And finally, DJI is a powerhouse when it comes to drones. Today, they marked the announcement of the new model in its best-selling series, the Phantom 4. One big feature is obstacle sensing. So it uses two front-facing sensors that steer the drone away from impact when they see an obstacle coming, or, you know, steer it up, whatever the case may be. Active track analyzes a person or a moving object. Basically, you can draw it on the tablet, however you're controlling the Phantom 4, and it will lock onto that person as they move around, and it'll know to continue to track that person or that object, whether they're facing the camera or not, because it, like, analyzes and does all this stuff, and basically just it is a really good tracking system for following a particular object. Really cool stuff.
Yeah, I don't want the NSA following me, but I would like my drone following me.
You want your little personal drone always right behind you?
It's pretty cool.
I mean, we're steps away from Flubber, guys. I don't know if anybody, saw the terrible Robin Williams movie, but he had a little flying assistant. And I'm like, pair that with Siri. You're really close. Though I will say, I think it was Mashable. I'm looking because I feel like Christina Warren tweeted about it. Mashable or one of the sites decided to attempt just how collision avoidant the drone was, and I believe someone tried to stick a banana right between its rotors, and unfortunately it wasn't quite intelligent to recognize
were the rotors strong enough to slice the banana, because then we found another reason. Oh, okay.
Right.
All right, you can slice a banana.
Banana slicing drones.
Not well, but
smash it, maybe, more likely.
Yeah.
Did you mention the price?
No.
$1,399.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. I think, yesterday we were talking about all the VR available for $3,000 or $800. It's like
the scale.
It seems like a lot to me, but again, enthusiasts will buy this.
Well, and here, like, there's so much autonomous stuff happening in this drone that they're saying this is most like an actual, like, textbook definition of drone than we've had in the enthusiast market, that you don't really need to know how to fly a drone very much. Like, it's almost taking that out of your hands based on all the automatic stuff it's doing, which is either a good or a bad thing, depending on how you want to define it. Because if you end up in trouble with this thing, you still got to know how to get it back.
Yeah. Fewer random crashes of $1,300 technology is always good.
But we're
going into the land of drone regulation, and we're seeing it move beyond the prosumer tinker crowd into not necessarily mainstream. But I'm really interested to see how drone footage and drones in general go forward in the next 5-10 years.
Yep.
Exactly. Well, all right. Next, we will have Elise Hu from NPR. She's all the way from South Korea to talk Sharp, Foxconn, and a little bit of Samsung news. But first, let's take a minute to thank NatureBox, the sponsor of this episode. NatureBox is the triple A of snacks. When hunger strikes, don't reach for that half-eaten bag of chips. Be prepared with smart and delicious snacks from NatureBox. I think you can. Jason's showing off the smart and delicious snacks.
I was going to come into your camera, but there they are.
You're
Checky.
What do we have there? Some dark cocoa.
They're
so good.
Mm-hmm. I'm covered, so I can't really see, but
apple pie, this one. Oak clusters.
I just want to steal that. Can I just reach through the screen and grab the apple pie oak clusters? Because those are so good.
We're working on that technology right now. We'll let you know
about that. Yeah, exactly. If you could get NatureBox following me around like a drone, that would be awesome. We all try to eat healthier, but that doesn't mean giving up flavor. They have all kinds of flavors that we've already mentioned. You can also have vegan snacks, no sugar added snacks, non-GMO options. You can choose between savory and sweet, salty and tart. There are over 100 unique and tasty options like sweet blueberry almonds and sriracha cashew crunch. Plus, you can fill out your snack profile and get personalized recommendations based on your preferences. The best part, NatureBox delivers right to your door. So fuel your game engine with healthy snacks. Visit naturebox.com/twit to get 50% off your first box now. That's naturebox.com/twit. Go there. Get 50% off your first box of delicious personalized snacks sent directly to your doorstep.
All right. Now joining us is someone who is no stranger to tech news today, Elise Hu from NPR. How's it going, Elise?
Going great. Hey, Jason. Hey, Megan.
Hey.
Great to have you here. Of course, you're calling in from the future. It's what, 17 hours in the future from where we are right now?
That's right. I'm 17 hours ahead of Pacific time. So the future is bright for you two.
Excellent. And it's morning time and time for breakfast in the future as well. And that works because I'm hungry. So here's a story that has been bubbling up the past week around Foxconn's possible buyout of Sharp, a company that's seen its share of financial troubles recently. What exactly happened that resulted in the on-again, off-again deal that's been reported in the news?
These two companies were... In fact, last Friday, when the deal was almost done, Foxconn's board had actually approved this buyout. It would have been a $6 billion buyout. A Taiwanese company after a Japanese company. I had actually gone on the air and wrote that this deal was almost done. But then at the 11th hour, it appears that Foxconn might be leaving Sharp at the altar or could possibly do so. But Sharp has no other buyers now. And so the issue or at issue, of course, is up to or around $3 billion in previously undisclosed possible liabilities. Reuters is reporting that this is kind of a worst case scenario list of possible liabilities that would encompass taxes that the company may owe to Japan and potential lawsuits that are left that haven't been resolved yet. Foxconn is saying that throughout the process, these weren't disclosed to them in the detail, that they didn't learn about this until the final 11th hour. And so there's a lot of dispute going on. So the deadline, which was originally February 29th to get this done, has now been extended until March 7th. There's acrimony and just bad feelings on both sides. Sharp kind of jumped on its press announcement of the buyout deal before Foxconn was ready. So this has been kind of a mess for the past few days now, and this is a very high stakes, especially for the Japanese company involved, because Sharp's stock has tanked 25% in the days following this botched deal.
Just in light of it. Now, what exactly is so different about a Japanese brand being sold to a company outside of Japan? I think I saw some of the stuff that you were reporting on this, and you made a comment to that effect. What did you mean by that?
That's right. Well, the Japanese tend to, and this is true for a lot of the Korean companies too. You know, it's a homogenous society, and then the companies tend to be like very close to the Japanese people and culture, such that they don't really like to have foreign buyers or haven't in the past. So, well, what would have been sort of unique or different about this is to allow a foreign buyer, in this case, Taiwan. Taiwanese company that has a lot of manufacturing plants in China to take over. And originally the opposing bidders, so the people on the other side, would have been a Japanese fund. So the company would have sort of, a Japanese company would have stayed in the hands of Japanese funders. And the competition here is quite different. So culturally, it's something that doesn't happen very often. So that's kind of what makes it unique. But also, as we've seen in the deal, there's some communication and cultural differences in just getting this deal done as well. So multiple layers.
So is there a danger of a monopoly situation here? Or is that a danger for anyone?
For Fox? for Foxconn? Well, I think the advantage, I don't think so. The advantage for Foxconn, of course, is that they're currently an iPhone assembler, and Sharp is one of the only three makers of the iPhone screens. And so there could be some synergies there, is what analysts are saying, but the deal is such a mess right now, and there's so many liabilities on the balance sheet of Sharp that they are having to take a second look, which isn't to say that this isn't going to happen, because Sharp doesn't really have any other suitors, but it's going to be kind of touch and go for the next few days as we watch to see what happens with a final deal, if it happens at all.
Yeah, if it happens at all. Like, it's kind of unfortunate that a miscommunication could potentially just affect the deal completely. Is there a high likelihood that could happen?
$1 billion deal.
Yeah. Yeah, high likelihood. So shifting gears a little bit, one big piece of news from Mobile World Congress last week was details on the LG G5. We talked about it on this show, and you had kind of mentioned when we were kind of leading up to this show that you've been somewhat taken by the modular aspects of the LG G5 and just kind of the potential of modularity in smartphones in general. Why do you think that's a big winner for the device, or do you? Do you think that's a great differentiator for this?
Well, I should say I was just kind of observing that LG, which is a crosstown rival that gets a lot less attention than Samsung around here and around the world, is kind of having to shift gears and make a renewed push after sort of playing second fiddle for a while. And at least they're trying something new with this modular approach. So essentially you can take the G5 apart and add a better camera lens or other parts. So a battery, optical zoom. And so that's exciting only because there's just so little innovation left in handsets. Mm-hmm. And LG was sort of lost the shuffle among handset makers for a long time. It essentially said that it's kind of giving up on the Chinese market completely and now making this renewed push in the US. So that'll be interesting to watch. But even Samsung, so even the winner here in Korea, or the longtime winner in Korea, is saying that they're kind of having to shift gears and move into biologics because there's only so much more margins they can get out of the smartphone market. And competition from China remains quite fierce. And so it'll be interesting to see whether LG can make headway in the United States, because that's kind of where they're banking on their product now.
Yeah, and Samsung is absolutely dominating all across the board as far as that's concerned. So that's quite a wall to be up against. But yeah, you're right. LG always really seems to play second fiddle to Samsung. Do you think is it marketing? Because the hardware on both of the newly announced devices are pretty fantastic. Do you think Samsung's just has far more marketing prowess?
Yeah, the marketing, Samsung wins a lot of points for its marketing, but also it got a bit of a head start. LG has been dominant in other appliances here in Asia, but also in the United States with televisions for a while, too. So they've been competing kind of in different arenas. They're very different companies culturally here. Both are considered chaebol here in Korea. Chaebol is the term that describes these multi-generational family-run conglomerates, and they have differing levels of government support, or they did in the very beginnings when they launched in the 1960s following the ravages of the Korean War. And so these are just different companies, slightly different companies. All Korean companies kind of have the same general characteristics, but these are different companies who are pushing different products for many years and now find themselves sort of going head-to-head.
Mm-hmm. So I know this isn't really your beat anymore, but what's the word on the street? Is there a lot of talk about the iPhone FBI encryption battle here among people that you hang out with in Korea, or is it not big news?
Well, the interesting debate in Korea is on national security in general right now. Actually, in South Korea, the longest ever filibuster in history in the world has been happening over the past week, and it's over a very controversial national security bill that would allow the spy agency here, so the equivalent of the CIA, to have even broader reach into the lives of citizens. And so the Apple encryption debate is a little bit more specific, but the larger questions about privacy and security are absolutely coming up in this society. It's one in which the conservatives or in the ruling party, the government here, can sort of use North Korea as an excuse to sort of say, hey, we're still technically at war. Therefore, we have to be able to sort of pry into your personal lives more to make sure that there aren't any spies among us and things like that. And so that argument of how far the government can go in the name of, quote unquote, national security is very real here on the peninsula.
I love the perspective that you have, obviously, being over there. It's a very different perspective. And I love the fact that we're able to even get you on the show, Elise. Tell people where they can follow all the work that you're doing with NPR.
That's right. I am blogging at elisegoeseast.tumblr.com. That is sort of my East Asia blog. And you can find me on Twitter at EliseWHO.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Elise. We'll have you back soon.
Great to see you guys.
All right,
great to
see
you. And now it's time to hear from you. Russell from St. Kitts and Nevis writes about our story yesterday about the run-in between Google's autonomous Lexus and a city bus. Russell wonders about the fact that Google's self-driving car is marked as such. He asks, how do we know the bus driver wasn't just being spiteful and assumed that the Google car would stop? If it were a real driver who might actually pull over the bus might have stopped. Interesting question. So I have wondered that, too, because I don't know if there are autonomous cars that aren't marked as autonomous out there in the wild.
I see. So what they're saying is the car would be so obviously an autonomous vehicle that the bus is like, yeah, we'll check this out.
Right. I'm going to let it hit me. I don't know if you're that.
I mean, I am a bus and I've got passengers and everything, but whatever. Take this autonomous car. I don't know.
Yeah,
skeptical.
Yeah.
But I definitely have heard that, like, sometimes they're afraid of them getting in accidents because everybody's looking at them. Like, everyone's like, look, there's the car.
Right.
And they're, like, distracted. And, you know, so I think that's definitely an issue.
Are they required to demonstrate to the public that it's autonomous?
I don't know the answer to the question. I know they're required to have someone in the car.
For sure.
I know that for sure, but yeah.
But I mean, it's pretty obvious because don't the autonomous cars have like the whole thing on the top?
You've got all of the telemetry and the 7 billion cameras on all sides. It's pretty. I was living in San Francisco when the first of the autonomous cars came through, and I actually there's one in Los Angeles that I saw when I was back there visiting my folks this past winter, and they're not unnoticeable.
Right.
I'd say they're very, but I've also never seen one with explicit like Google car branding. So it's entirely possible that this car wasn't Google branded. But again, because there's a person in the car, it kind of negates the like, well, they have to be branded for public safety. Mm-hmm. Because theoretically, the person in the car should be able to stop or at least avert horrible things from happening in this testing phase.
Sure.
There was a crash, but you know.
Well, and even the driver said, I would have done the same thing that the autonomous car was doing. Like, I made the same assumption that the car made. So
yeah. The bus had the right of way, but then it just, he assumed that the bus was going to stop?
I guess so. Hey,
yeah.
People are imperfect, and apparently so are autonomous cars.
Well, that's the thing. Autonomous cars have to have a certain, not necessarily morality, but they have to have a certain set of functions based on what a human might do. And that, of course, that gets you into the bigger question about autonomous cars and morality, where it's like, well, when it's figuring out what a bus might do if a bus comes into your line of vision, well, there's also the question of what happens if there's a small child that runs into your field of vision, and there's also a dog if you turn to the right. There are things that we're in such early days with autonomous cars, we haven't been able to tackle those questions yet.
Yeah, such complexity.
Mm-hmm.
Up next, Microsoft is buckling down on its security with a focus on social engineering. But first, let's take a minute to thank the sponsor of this episode, Scorebig. What are you doing this weekend? Sitting on your butt watching paint dry? Yeah, I know. Instead, how about sitting on your butt inside a theater for your favorite Broadway show, maybe Hamilton? Or you could sit on your butt in your favorite auditorium watching an awesome musician perform, let's say Bruce Springsteen. You could even sit on your butt inside a theater watching your kid's favorite Disney characters skate and sing. Deep down, you know you want to watch Frozen on Ice. I can see it in your eyes. Well, whatever it happens to be, you can bet that there's a way to pay less for better seats at these events. How? Just go to scorebig.com. 40% of all live event tickets go unsold. Scorebig is making it easy to attend live events by working directly with your favorite teams and artists to get their unsold seats at unpublished prices. At scorebig.com, you are always guaranteed huge savings by paying much less than what the box office charges for tickets. They have incredible deals on tickets to concerts, sports games, Broadway productions, family-friendly events. To take advantage of all of these deals, visit scorebig.com, and you'll find the event and the seats that you want. Then you make an offer with ScoreBig's name a ticket price feature, and you'll receive an answer from ScoreBig instantly, and you'll save up to 60% on your tickets. You also have an option to pay a fixed price, which is much less expensive than major online ticket resellers. With ScoreBig, there are no surprise fees, and you get free shipping. You can even favorite your shows as well as the events that are shown on the site to be notified on upcoming dates to attend, which is such a convenient feature. I love that one. Quit overpaying for tickets. Get the tickets you want at prices you can afford with ScoreBig. The next time you're planning to attend a game or a show, visit ScoreBig first and see how much you can save. Go to scorebig.com, click on the microphone, and enter promo code TNT to save an extra $20 off your first ticket price. That's scorebig.com, promo code TNT. And we thank ScoreBig for their support.
It is so refreshing to talk about security, not of an iPhone. Matt Weinberger from Business Insider recently got the chance to talk to Microsoft's Terry Myerson about protecting enterprises against social engineering. Welcome, Matt.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. So today, Microsoft revealed Windows Defender Advanced Threat Protection. What can you tell us about it?
There's a lot of vowels in there, consonants. No, it's actually very cool because Windows 10, security is a big piece of it, despite all the hubbub over whether or not it's sending your information to Microsoft. That's a separate issue. But the idea is that when Microsoft wants a billion users on Windows 10, a lot of those users are going to be in enterprises, big companies, banks, hospitals, yada, 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 yada. They want security. And then in the age of Sony and Home Depot and Target and whatever, it's kind of taken for granted that the best security software in the world, someone's going to get in, right? And at that point, it's about damage control. It's now naive to assume that no one can get into your network ever.
So this is cloud security, they were describing it, but not right. As like not protecting your cloud, but using the cloud to be more secure?
That's right. That's right. So what it does is the big idea is Microsoft has basically a finger in every pie, if you want to think of it in a really creepy way. they analyze tons of web traffic, tons of data from Windows 10 computers, tons of data from basically anywhere. They're big. They're everywhere. They know what normal looks like, and they know what abnormal looks like, if you know what I mean. So if something, so using that huge, huge, huge sample set of data, they can tell when something's already happened and alert you where maybe you wouldn't even know until credit card information started getting posted on the darknet.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, last week Snapchat, someone at Snapchat turned over a bunch of payroll data because they thought that they were talking to Evan Spiegel, the CEO, and they were or emailing probably, and they were not. How does that work? How does technology protect us against being, I don't want to say stupid, but naive?
So that's kind of the catch, right? You can't protect against that. All it takes is one person believing that the email is from Evan Spiegel, and then all the software in the world isn't going to protect you from someone who means well and who has an email password, you know? So at that point, it's about mitigating the risk because until everyone on the planet learns to check and make sure that an email is from who they say it's from, it's not going away.
Interesting, this story kind of ties into an announcement that Google made today. They released a security feature for Gmail that OCR scans attachments in your emails as you're setting them up for sensitive information before the email is sent. Kind of feels like a new wave of security right now, security protection, where we're being protected from ourselves. Kind of like
that's right.
Protected from making that stupid decision. Is this a new focus? Have we seen this much before? I feel like security has long been, kind of about about intruders, let's say. But now we're being protected from ourselves. Is that more effective, do you think?
I think that I would actually say so. The problem is when you talk about network level security, it's always an arms race. There are people cracking networks fast as the most cutting edge security experts are closing holes. That's why you get Heartbleed, stuff like that, right? But like the vast majority of issues, the vast majority of data breaches, you know, first off, they don't make the news. And second off, it's because people mean well and accidentally leak everything everywhere. So I think that technology is now at a point where it can more safely guard us against ourselves. For there have been email systems for a while that are like, if you're sharing a social security number or someone's medical records, you know, it'll scan the text of the email and be like, you probably shouldn't share that credit card number. Mm-hmm. That's existed for a while. But the ability to actually look at documents and actually get a better sense for what people are actually sharing, that's something where technology has caught up with the concept. If that makes sense.
It does. So it's not available yet, but they've been using it internally at Microsoft. Did you get any word for how it was working so far for them?
So Microsoft, I asked Microsoft if they were using it internally, and all I got is we found some stuff, which right, which I was like, yeah, I'm sure you did. I'd like to read that report, but no. So they're testing it internally mostly. There are some early customers, but stuff like this, when you're dealing with data that's this sensitive, you don't want to rush it into production, right? You don't want to rush it out into the world. So they're making it available to Windows 10 insiders first, which is their beta program. After they get a really good sense for how it's working, then they're going to start talking about rolling it out. And just to be totally clear, this is for businesses. So even though your consumer, you know, your Windows 10 laptop might be feeding data into the Great Beast, you're not going to have this particular technology on your personal computer necessarily.
And did they say that might be something they would do in the future for personal use?
I think so. Windows has Windows Defender, which is its built-in antivirus solution. I will eat my shoe on Neil Cavuto if something like this, some kind of data detection thing doesn't come back to Windows Defender at some point. But the whole idea of scanning a whole wide, broad network, it's not something that most people would find super useful anyway.
Mm-hmm. We have him on record saying that he'll eat a shoe.
Right.
Editor, note that for the shoe eating thing.
That's right. There that's we go. Right. Well, if you happen to have Neil Cavuto on speed dial, then you can make this happen.
I feel like that comment did more for Neil Cavuto than anyone else, because I was like, I didn't know who that was before.
I don't know. I think this is the year John goes all the way.
There you go.
I would like to say, well, Matt, thank you so much for joining us. Matt thank Weinberger you. Is at Business Insider and at Gameoid on Twitter. And I know that you recently got to play Minecraft on the Oculus Rift. Is that correct?
I did. And it was awesome. And it has me sitting there on the Dell website trying to figure out if I can afford an Oculus gaming rig. Who would think that Minecraft with blocks would be the killer app that made me go, yeah, all
right. Right. This well, cool. It's cheaper.
It seems perfect, actually. It seems like perfectly right? made for it.
Yeah.
And who didn't want to encompass themselves in a world of Legos when they were seven and exactly. still exactly. secretly right. harbors that today?
And it's like when you're exploring a cave on your computer, it's like, oh, yeah, cool cave. But when it's in VR, it's like, oh, my God, this cave is horrible and I'm claustrophobic and yada, yada.
Right. That's and you awesome. Can get that for the low, low
really
price.
Across.
Yeah. And yeah, you can play on the Oculus Rift for $600 plus the computer,
that's
whereas you,
exactly
you know,
right.
have to
I'm
pay.
I'm thinking of selling a kidney or a lung.
Okay, good to know. If you guys want to watch that video, it's up on Business Insider, and Matt links to it on Twitter, too. So thank you so much, Matt.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good one.
You too. All right, TNT's fan of the day is at, well, another Matt, Matt Borkin on Twitter, who says, quote, I watch TNT on a Nexus 6P through an iPhone 6 and then through an iPhone 6S. Nested TNT. I'm sure many people watch this way. That, or you are the only one on earth who watches this way. Either way, one of those is true. Show us how
it's
you
commitment.
Watch.
Yes.
It really is.
Hey, well, you know, we got three views out of that, right? Is that how it works, right? Mm-hmm. You watch it in three different ways? No, I don't think it works like that. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video where you can take a picture of yourself or your setup. Post it to Instagram, Google+, Twitter, Facebook. Use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT and we will find it.
All right, well, Andy Rubin's dog is smarter than all of us. Watch the video after the break. But first, let's take a minute to thank PillPack, the sponsor of this episode. A pharmacy used to be the center of town, a quaint place where you went to catch up on the day's news and gossip and catch each other's colds. But these days, most pharmacies are huge chains and we're all just faceless customers that no one recognizes. But you can still catch someone's cold if you're there. PillPack is the future of pharmacies and it's available now. PillPack delivers your medications and vitamins pre-sorted in these easy-to-tear packets labeled with a date and time for each dose. So you can get rid of that antiquated Monday to Sunday pill box. PillPack uses robots. They sort and fill personalized pill packs separately for each customer. Each packet dispensed in the pharmacy is sent through an image recognition system that they built to ensure the right pill is in the right pack. Their system can detect dispensing accuracy by size, shape, color, and density of each pill, and catalogs an image of every single packet dispensed. In addition, each packet is checked by a pharmacist for accuracy and interactions prior to shipment. If you ever have any questions, their pharmacists are available to you 24/7 from the privacy of your own home. No more long lines or awkward pharmacy encounters. They proactively contact your doctor to manage your refills for you so you never run out. Switching to PillPack is easy. Sign up on their secure site and they will take care of everything for you. They're also compatible with major insurance plans, most of them, including most forms of Medicare Part D. No extra costs beyond your standard copays. Shipping is always free. There's also a PillPack medication reminder app for the iPhone and for your Apple Watch. PillPack has brought the pharmacy into the digital age, and once you make the switch, you'll wonder how you ever lived without it. Visit pillpack.com/twit to sign up now. Their site is beautiful. It only takes 5 minutes to sign up. When you use our link and transfer your prescriptions to PillPack, you'll get a credit for $20 worth of vitamins and OTCs. That's pillpack.com/TWIT. Well, you might know Andy Rubin as the former head of Android or the previous manager of Google's robotics division, which includes Boston Dynamics. But I know Andy Rubin as the owner of the dog who will save us from the robots. Let's watch the video. So there's Andy Rubin's dog.
And so cute.
He is really cute.
Well, I mean, that's Andy Rubin's dog also, isn't it?
So, yeah, that's Spot. That was the military grade robot that they know they put him out of commission last year. I don't know if you heard they put him out to pasture because he was too they were too loud, and even though they could run really fast, a lot faster than you, but yeah, they no longer use them because they were they weren't good for the military.
That little trotting just kind of freaks me out every time I see it. It's that is one brave dog. That's all I gotta say.
Serenity, I'm a fan of your dogs. I see them on Instagram a lot, and I enjoy your photos of them. So I know that you know about barking dogs. What do you think about dog versus robot dog?
Well, I have to say I'm impressed with Andy Rubin's furry dog. Especially, you know what? It's clear he's trying to figure out whether or not the robot dog is a threat or is just waiting to play. Because he's in this sort of like half haunch position. Mm-hmm. And now he's going all the way back on his hind legs, which looks like, hey, you look like somebody to play with. You're not attacking me. Come on, do something. Do something already. He's hurting him right now. He's just kind of like, hey, go this way. Go this way. Let's play. Totally. Where are you going?
Don't run into the car, though.
Yeah, oh. Where are you going? Well, he's a remote controller.
Oh, okay.
Do me a favor by that car.
First, yeah, we poke them with sticks. Then we sick our dogs on them.
So
what next, huh? What next?
So sad. Did you guys see the redo of that video with just sad Boston Dynamics robot, where they just make a voiceover of him and he's just like, Box, I love Box. Please don't take Box from me. And then it goes, you know, in a predictable Terminator-esque place where the robot storms out the door is like. You know, Dave taught me Box's love. I must now crush Dave's love. Dave loves family. It's very funny and very cute. But you know what? On one hand, I think that the Boston Dynamic robots are incredibly cool as a robotics lover, but also incredibly terrifying. Cheetah speed running robots probably have really, really useful places in things like war. Things that can crouch down like that. Poor Andy Rubin's dog is just like, well, you're lying down now, but I really hope we were going to play.
So with cats, all you need is a little laser pointer.
Yeah.
With dogs, all you need is a Boston Dynamic robot dog.
Yeah.
And in a perfect world, we would all have one, and our actual dogs would have companions.
Yeah. Steve Jurvetson, he's a partner at the VC firm DFJ. He took the video And he also coined the term the uncanine valley.
Oh. He needs to go to moon jail for that pun, I think.
I kind of like it. Moon-canine.
My other favorite part of that video is like all the people talking, you know, underneath the video that they probably, I mean, they must have assumed it would go viral. But, you know, someone was saying like, oh, wouldn't it be poetic justice if Andy Rubin's dog got taken out by the robot? I wonder if that guy still has his job.
Yeah.
Especially considering it was on a remote control. So if that happened, yeah, that
it
actually
would be Andy Rubin's fault.
Yes, right. Exactly. That was one of his staffers.
I don't know if Rubin was piloting it, but yeah. Still, yeah.
He's like, finally, I have the ability to stick it to Andy Rubin.
Well, Serenity, it has been a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much. Thanks for rushing in at the last minute to make it here, even though you're teaching a class at Emerson. What else are you up to?
Oh, gosh. Let's see. Well, I play roller derby, which is kind of my not-so-secret pastime. I'm playing with Providence roller derby this season, which I'm pretty excited about. At iMore, doing lots of really, really cool stuff on upcoming iPads, on potential rumors of the iPhone SE. I've been doing a weekly iPhonography column on iMore as well. And when I'm not doing tech stuff or roller derby stuff, you can find me on the Incomparable.com's radio theater podcast. We're in the middle of our first season. And if you like stories or old-timey radio, or you just enjoy podcasts from tech nerds doing ridiculous theater and ridiculous accents, it's a pretty good time, and I recommend people check it out.
Yeah, it is fantastic.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Serenity.
So great getting you on, Serenity. Thank you.
Take care.
We'll talk
Bye.
To you soon.
Pleasure.
See you guys. All right. Tomorrow's guest will be Lindsay Turrentine from CNET. Welcoming back Lindsay once again. TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 12 a.m. UTC at twit.tv/live. You can be a part of the show. Just email us tnt@twit.tv or leave us a short voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW. And you can find the show on Twitter. We are at Tech News Today TV.
We are also on YouTube and we're on Facebook, but the best way to get our show right away is to subscribe to it at twit.tv/TNT. We also have a newsletter. You can find that at twit.tv/newsletter and find us on Twitter. I am at Megan Maroney.
And I am at Jason Howell on Twitter. Thanks to our technical director, Kara Cole, and all the folks who help us produce this show every single day. And thanks to you for talking tech with us today. We'll see you tomorrow. Bye, everyone.